Welcome to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. I'm Sarah of the blog Sarah's Bookshelves. Each week, I'm talking with one bookish guest about two old books they love, two new books they love, one book they don't love, and one new release they're excited about. We're going to get real and sometimes a bit snarky about all things books. If you like the show, I'd really love your support. Spread the word to your reader friends, subscribe to the show, rate and review it wherever you listen to podcasts, or get bonus podcast episodes by supporting the podcast on Patreon. There's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Let's get rolling. Hey, everyone. Welcome to a full-length episode of Sarah's Bookshelves Live. Today, we're talking about a book that's fun but still deals with really important issues. And it joins my two forms of entertainment together, books and reality TV, specifically The Bachelor franchise. Kate Stayman London, author of the debut novel and now USA Today bestseller One to Watch, is joining me today. Kate is a novelist, screenwriter, and political strategist. She served as lead digital writer for Hillary Rodham Clinton's 2016 presidential campaign and has written for notable figures ranging from President Obama to Malala Yousafzai to Anna Wintour to Cher. She lives in Los Angeles, where she's currently melting in an uncharacteristic 100-plus degree heat. Welcome, Kate.
Hi, it's so nice to be here.
So glad to have you, and I hope you're surviving out there. I know y'all aren't used to that kind of thing. So I'm a huge fan of The Bachelor and The Bachelorette and all of the surrounding shows. So I was really excited when I first heard about One to Watch, and for y'all, One to Watch fictionalizes a bachelor-type show called Main Squeeze in the book, and it features a plus-size blogger as the lead of the show. And I love a book that reads fun and light, but that deals with serious topics, and One to Watch really hit that exact right spot for me. So it was a super bright spot in my summer.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. Thank you so much.
Of course. And for those of y'all who have not read One to Watch yet, can you tell us a little bit more about the plot without giving away spoilers, obviously?
Absolutely. So One to Watch follows the story of Bea Schumacher, who is a devastatingly stylish plus-size blogger. And Bea has this great life, huge Instagram followers, terrific family, wonderful friends, and a totally massively broken heart. And this is when she, one drunken night, goes on a Twitter rant about her favorite reality show, which in the book is called Main Squeeze, but which, as you mentioned, may remind folks of the Bachelor Bachelorette franchise. And her tweet thread goes totally viral. And then the producers of the show come to approach her to ask her to be the next star, essentially the next Bachelorette, with 25 men competing for her affections. And Bea, with her broken heart, is just not in a place to be dating. So she strikes a deal with the producer and says, okay, I'll come on the show, but on one condition: under no circumstances am I actually going to fall in love. So the book follows the story that once, you know, she goes on the show and meets some of the men that are actually going to be competing for her, it gets a little bit more complicated. And the real question is, can she open herself up to try and find love again, not just in her own life, but in front of millions of viewers? And who's really there for the right reasons? And it's a little bit of a mystery on that front. And that's One to Watch.
You went from writing digital content for Hillary Clinton to writing fiction about reality TV. That's two very different endeavors. How did you make that switch? And why did you make that switch?
Yeah, well, I've always worked in both politics and sort of screenwriting fiction. I've, you know, ever since I was in high school and I was president of the theater club and president of the Model UN club, hard to overstate how popular I was back then. but yeah, so I started out working in politics in DC, decided that wasn't for me, moved to LA to get my master's degree in screenwriting, and then was kind of going back and forth doing political consulting as my day job while I was taking out pitches and going out for staffing on TV shows in LA. And then a friend of mine who I'd worked with got hired to be Secretary Clinton's digital director in 2015. And she reached out to me and said, hey, Kate, you want to come and write for the campaign? And I was like, no, I don't want to do that at all. I'm very happy in Los Angeles. Thank you. She was like, well, you know, we've known each other a long time. Just take a couple calls. And so, of course, a week later, I accepted a job and packed up and moved to Brooklyn 2 weeks after that. So I was there from the very beginning. And so after the election in 2016, it was a tough moment for me.
Sure.
And I had always planned to come back to LA and continue my writing career. That was always the plan. But I had thought that I was going to write sort of a political rom-com, a kind of Bridget Jones on the campaign trail kind of a story.
Oh, interesting.
And I found that I couldn't do it when it came time to actually sit down and write the pages. It was just too raw for me, and I couldn't do it. So I was looking for other stories to write, and this was early 2017, and I was watching, at that time, it was Nick Viall's season of The Bachelor, because I've been a huge fan of the franchise since the very beginning. And that's sort of where I get my escape. And so it was March of 2017. It was the season finale of Nick's season. And this idea just kind of hit me like a bolt of thunder. What if a plus-size woman was the star of a show like The Bachelorette? And it was such a simple premise, but the more I thought about it, the more I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I knew there was really a story there. So I stayed up until 2 a.m. that night and wrote just like a 4-page little proposal for my literary agent. And she was like, I love this. Do you think you can actually write more than 3 pages? And I was like, let's find out. So I sat down that weekend and wrote the entire first chapter, and we sold it to Random House 3 months later, I think. So it was really just about me sort of seeking that comfort and that escape that I was looking for in early 2017, but also bringing to it the same kind of values and ideology that drive the work that I do in the political sphere.
Was there a specific moment during Nick Viall's finale that this hit you? Did something happen in that episode that caused this idea to come into your head?
He picked Vanessa, right? That was her name. And yep. I was in a league that year and I had picked her and I won. And
oh, nice.
Well, same old, same old. She looks the same as every other woman who's ever won this show. And I bet they'll break up in 6 to 8 weeks. And of course they did. And
yeah.
And like, I had been a Nick fan sort of more prior to his season. I liked him a lot on Andy's season and Caitlin's season. And I was just, I felt disappointed in him. I felt like he bought into the same kind of garbage that eats the brains of everyone who goes on that show. And I was just like, man, what would it look like if someone like him was dating someone who felt more like an actual woman and not just a carbon copy of every other woman who's ever been on that show? And I think it was just the totality of like, it doesn't matter which woman he picks because they're all kind of the same.
They're all the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
So who do you think he should have picked?
Oh, I mean, well, Rachel is the girl.
Yes, but yes, she's awesome.
I certainly buy into the conspiracy theory that he would have picked her had she not been recruited to be The Bachelorette. I don't know if that's true or not, but I believe in my heart that it's true.
I feel like producers had her pegged early that she was going to be the next Bachelorette.
And I mean, thank God. She's like, I know we'll get to this later, but she is, she's the greatest.
She is awesome. So you said you've always been a fan of The Bachelorette. Did you start watching way back with Alex Michelle or Trista? Like, how far back do you go with this?
Oh, Alex Michelle, very first season, my freshman year in college, I watched with my friends Leslie and Maura, who lived on my hall freshman year. And I, being the insufferable 18-year-old that I was, wrote a letter to ABC, which I signed Kate Stain in London, Amherst College Political Science Department, which I had taken one class in that department, so that was a stretch. I wrote them a letter saying I really loved their new show, The Bachelor, but I felt that it was sexist that they didn't have a companion show called The Bachelorette because they were saying that one man is worth 25 women and not the other way around. So they never wrote me back, but frankly, I'm still waiting for my residual check for having invented The Bachelorette when I was 18 years old.
Are you the seed for this? Did they completely just steal your idea?
Listen, Mike Fleiss. No. So, you know, so I've been with it since the very, very beginning. There are a few seasons in the middle that I missed. I think like when I was in grad school and when I was on the campaign trail, there were seasons I didn't watch. But for the most part, I've seen almost every season.
I'm a reader of Reality Steve's blog. I love to be spoiled. I love all the behind the scenes. And I really thought you absolutely nailed all that. As much as I know, not having been on the show, how did you go about doing all your research for the behind the scenes stuff?
Yeah, well, some of it, you know, I live and work in Los Angeles as a screenwriter, so I have some familiarity just with how networks and studios and executives and producers and that whole world and how it works. So that was definitely helpful. And then I read a few books. I read Andy's book and I read Amy Kaufman's book, Bachelor Nation, and did a little of that. And I also you know, when Chris Harrison does podcasts and stuff, he tends to be pretty candid in terms of talking about how things work behind the scenes.
He does.
So I listened to a lot of interviews with him. But then also, it was great for me to sort of be like, okay, I can get a really strong foundation here for how things work behind the scenes. But also, it's a novel. So there are some things like I changed the structure of the show to make it a little more like Love Island UK, where in my book, the dates that film 1 week air the following Monday night. And could they pull off something like that with all the different locations? Maybe. I think it probably wouldn't be doable.
Maybe this season with Claire, they could.
Right. Like if you're going to be all in one location, you can pull off something like that. But if you're traveling all around the world like they do in the book or like they do on The Bachelor, I don't think that that's really realistic. You need more time to get that footage back and edit it. So, you know, there were some things that I was able to sort of skirt by having it be fiction. But for the most part, I wanted you to have that feeling of feeling like if you're a fan of this show, this could really be what it's like to be behind the scenes on that show.
Absolutely. And I think you did a great job with that.
Oh, thank you.
Were you able to talk to any like past contestants prior as part of your research? I know you've talked to Ashley Spivey since then.
Yeah, no. So I wasn't able. I did a friend of a friend as a producer. And right when I was first starting a producer on The Bachelor, and right when I was first starting work on the book, she introduced us and we had drinks. And she didn't give me too much behind the scenes info. But my real concern was I thought that maybe there was a chance they might cast a plus size person before the book came out and kind of scoop me. And so I said, you know, is there any chance of this happening? And she was like, absolutely not. There's no chance.
Would that have derailed the book?
I don't think so. But I think one question people really ask me a lot is, did you always know how the book was going to end or has it changed or whatever? And most of the plot has stayed exactly the same from the very beginning. But there were a few things, like there was one contestant who his sort of reveal in his storyline was that he had a secret girlfriend. But then the summer that I was writing the first draft was the summer of Rachel Lindsay's season when DeMario had the secret girlfriend. And my editor was like, I don't think we should do this storyline. I think it's too similar. So there were a few things like that where we wanted to make sure we were trying to differentiate what was happening in the book from what happened in real life. But, you know, I think the idea that of the book, it's supposed to be pushing for something.
Sure.
Right? It's supposed to be asking for something. And if that thing was already happening, then I think it could be, you know, just as effective as a work of literature, but perhaps not as effective as a tool for social justice, which is obviously a secondary aim.
Did you have any sort of, I guess you and or your publisher have any sort of legal concerns about fictionalizing, but obviously fictionalizing a real show and kind of exposing some behind the scenes stuff and calling them out for some stuff?
No, actually, Random House and their legal team was super supportive, even to the extent that I thought because there are so many like sort of celebrity tweets and stuff throughout the book, and I had sort of intentionally spelled everyone's name wrong to avoid any legal issues there. But Random House Legal, they were like, no, you know what? It's a work of fiction. We have on the copyright page, it's all resemblance to actual people is purely coincidental. Everyone understands that it's a work of fiction.
Sure.
You're totally fine. So I was really surprised actually at how supportive they were in terms of saying, no, you're great and we love what you're doing.
And I mean, you have some huge differences in there too, namely the lead, B.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about her. She was awesome. I loved her. I loved that she was so strong, but also really vulnerable. And I thought those two things just meshed in a really believable way for her as a character. And I loved how you could sort of see her come into herself and progress and grow throughout the story. Can you talk a little bit about your inspiration for her? And was there any sort of real life model for you as you were writing her?
You know, one thing that I've heard from readers that I love, and I've heard from so many readers who are plus size women who tell me how seen they feel by reading about B and her story, which means the absolute world to me because that was the goal. They've said that often when you see a plus size woman in books, she's just expected to be a really tough boss bitch all the time. And that's not their lives. That's not my life. That's not anyone's life, I don't think. So I really wanted in B to create a character who she is really tough and she is a boss bitch and she is an incredible, brave, courageous career woman. And she does feel really insecure. And she does have a hard time being vulnerable with people. And she does have insecurities and fears. And to find, as you say, that balance. I follow a lot of plus size bloggers on Instagram. And one of the most important sort of text threads in my life, which is a funny thing to say, but I feel like it's a real thing, is I'm on a group thread of 5 plus size women who all worked for Hillary Clinton in 2016.
Oh, wow. Yes.
And it's a group of 5 women who are like the toughest people who've run presidential campaigns, people who run national movements, people who are regularly on TV. And we talk about how hard it is to find clothes that fit us and our insecurities. And we send each other pictures of our outfits and give each other encouragement. And having that space and that community is such an important part of my life. And so I really wanted to capture sort of that group of women and how inspiring they've been to me in Bea and in her story.
You mentioned earlier that you wanted Bea to go in thinking, absolutely, I am never going to find love through this. I am doing this for my career. I will go through the motions. How did you decide to have her go into the show Main Squeeze with that mentality?
You know, with every character, you want to have an arc that they start in one place and end in a really different place. So for Bea, having her be in this place, and it's a really traditional romantic comedy trope, right? Which is usually you have the two leads meet each other and they hate each other right away. And then by the end, oh, they love each other. And it's funny because it is a rom-com, right? But actually, if you want to get into the weeds about story structure, traditionally, a rom-com has 2 protagonists, which is why in a lot of rom-com novels, you have switching perspectives. You go back and forth because that's the way those stories are structured. And One to Watch is technically a single protagonist story with one person's arc. And so even though the context of the book is that it's a romantic comedy, sort of the way that it's structured is it's about Bea and her emotional journey. And because, of course, the issue isn't that she won't fall in love on reality TV.
Right.
The issue is that she won't fall in love at all. It's that she's hung up on this guy, that she's not ready to try dating someone new, that she feels unworthy or undeserving of love, and that's about the way that she views herself and the negative things she says about herself. So that arc was really the most important to me in terms of figuring out, okay, yes, obviously she's going on a romance show. There are going to be romances in the book. There are a lot of them to keep track of. They're a lot of fun. They're exciting. They're steamy. But ultimately, what it comes down to is this main character and her journey from being a person who says, no, I won't find love, to a person who is ready to do that.
I almost said something spoilery.
I know. I went on Reality Steve's podcast, and he's, you know, the king of spoilers. And he was like, how am I supposed to do this when we can't talk about spoilers? And I was like, Steve, we can have a spoiler section. He was like, oh, thank God. It was funny. Steve, actually, the day he called me to record that, he had just found out that Tayshia was going to be the new Bachelorette. Like,
oh, no way.
Minutes. But like, he literally texted me to be like, can I call you 10 minutes late? And something is breaking. And I was like, sure, no problem. And he was like, you're not going to believe what I just found out. And I was like, Steve, no spoilers. He was like, you're going to want to know this one.
So wait, are you a spoiler-free Bachelor watcher?
I am a spoiler-free Bachelor watcher. And this is my stepmom, to whom the book is dedicated, my stepmom, Dee Dee. Uh-huh. She's a huge Bachelor fan. Also, we always watch together, and she always reads Reality Steve, and I never read Reality Steve. And so we have a fight every single episode where she's like, I know what happens. And I'm like, I know, you know, don't tell me.
So when you said that you picked Vanessa in Nick's pool, I assumed you had read Reality Steve and picked Vanessa.
No.
And you actually won legitimately.
We have very strict spoiler-free rules in the Bachelorette pool.
That's only fair, I think. Well, congratulations. That's a big deal.
I'm pretty good at, look, I mean, the producers also, they tip their hand on the first night with who gets camera time and things like that.
Yeah, sure.
We always really carefully watch this season on at the end of the premiere to like see who's going to show up in the later dates. So you get like some hints that way. But I feel like I've gotten pretty okay at predicting from watching the first episode who's going to win the season.
So speaking of Tayshia, we think she might be the new Bachelorette. There's been no official announcement. No one really knows, you know. All points lead to yes. So she would be the second African-American Bachelorette after Rachel. So obviously, racial diversity has been a huge discussion topic surrounding The Bachelor and The Bachelorette in a certain segment of viewers for a long time, in a broader segment of viewers more recently through The Bachelor Diversity Campaign. So how did you sort of decide to go with the body image angle of diversity rather than, say, race or sexuality or any of the other levels of diversity you could have gone with?
Well, I think that, first of all, that racial diversity and sexuality and gender identity, like, those are all really important pieces of diversity to me. And they're all in the book and called out specifically as important areas of diversity in the book.
Absolutely, they are.
So I think that's really important. But in terms of sort of why focus on body diversity, I think that what The Bachelor taps into is this idea of idealized womanhood. And idealized womanhood is so connected to thinness and to a specific kind of beauty standard, and in a way that is so damaging to an overwhelming majority of women, right? Because we're not just talking about some small subset. It's 2/3 of American women wear size 14 and above, right? The average is, I think, 16 to 18. It changes all the time. And who knows what clothes size means anyway, but
right.
And to me, beauty standards and fat phobia specifically, it's part of a larger, we can get as deep on this as you want to on this podcast. It's part of a larger system that is about controlling women's power by controlling our bodies. And this is a system that's about our access to healthcare and specifically reproductive care. It's about the way we have to look if we want to apply for a certain job, the way our voices need to sound. Knowing that fat women, it's not just about romance or beauty standards or anything, quote unquote, frivolous. It is about you're less likely to get a job if you're fat.
Right.
Your difficulties accessing healthcare at all and being so deeply prejudiced, facing prejudice from doctors who will ignore your symptoms and say, lose weight, even if you have cancer, for example, that a lot of times we hear stories and see stories from fat people saying they simply don't go to their doctors anymore because all they receive is shame for their bodies instead of care for their bodies, which is what you are looking for when you are visiting your doctor, presumably. So for me, it was such a strong unity of sort of issues I care so much about, but also something that is so specific to this show and the way this show presents what you're quote unquote supposed to look like. And it's like, who's deciding, right? So I think in the case of The Bachelor, the who's deciding are the men who run the show. So it's no coincidence that really in the first chapter of One to Watch, there are sort of two big inciting incidents. The first is Bee's tweet storm that I mentioned that goes viral. And the second is that a new executive producer is promoted on the show Main Squeeze, who's a woman. And she's a woman who sees herself, she's a complicated character, but she sees herself as a feminist. And she thinks that casting a fat woman as a lead on a show like this is a feminist empowering thing to do. And she's right about that. So I think a lot of what I wanted to write about was sort of both Bee and her experience sort of being on camera, but also the importance of who's behind the camera and who's empowered to make these decisions. Because I think that's really important too.
I'm thinking about The Bachelor and, like, you said size 14 and above women, 2/3 of American women are size 14 and above. And I think about The Bachelor, and it's not even that they cast normal thin women. At this point in time, they cast model thin women.
Yes.
And men, honestly, like every guy on there mostly looks like they're a personal trainer for their job.
And half of them are.
Right. It's true. Fair.
When the book came out, I went to stay with some cousins and they had never seen The Bachelor. And so we were watching an old season. We watched about Ashley Haber's season of The Bachelorette because that's the season that was most influential to me in writing this book. And I wanted to start them there and sort of seeing what she went through. I remember watching that season and being like, William, the cell phone salesman, was on there and sort of being like, oh, these guys, what are their jobs? But like, at least they had jobs. And like,
oh, now they don't even have them anymore.
Now when you look at it, people don't even, because they're, it's just a sort of feeding ground to be an Instagram influencer, and no shade, like everyone has to make a living. I just don't personally find it that interesting to watch when it's like, that is sort of what everyone is doing. And that was sort of another part of what I wanted to write about, was not just what if we were more diverse in terms of our appearances, but also what if people had more interesting things to talk about than their past relationships, and we could like talk about other topics and our jobs and sort of see different things happening. So that was a big part of it too.
Have you been watching the re-airings of some of the old seasons that they've been doing this summer?
I've watched some of them. I haven't. They're so long. I can't always get through them, if I'm honest.
I only watch them on DVR where I can fast forward.
I watched JoJo's season. That was a good one. And Ben H's.
Yep.
Maybe one other one. I don't remember.
I watched, I guess it was the double episode with Alex, Michelle, and Trista, who, you know.
Classic.
And I thought that season, even though you could tell they didn't have all that producer manipulation going on, or probably some, but like not to the extent it is now, I was so much more interested in those people because they generally had jobs. They were regular people. They didn't know what The Bachelor was when they signed up to be on the show. So there wasn't all that sort of expectation and like, oh, I'm going to play X role. They also looked more normal and they were still thin, but like they looked like someone you would meet on the street. Some of the contestants that go on now, I feel like they're not people that you would be with and hang out with in your real life unless you hang out with a bunch of Instagram models.
Totally. You know, on Alex and Trista's season, the early seasons, going back and watching them, because I think Alex's whole season or Trista's whole season was on the ABC app on my Apple TV.
Oh, okay.
A year or two ago, and I went back and watched. And it's definitely more boring because it's more slow without that producer manipulation. But it is, there's like that realness that's really exciting. And now I feel like we've swung too far in the other direction where it's like the episodes are really exciting because there's so much manipulation going on and so much is happening. But also to the point where it's like not real enough because you can really kind of see the seams of all the strings that are being pulled behind the scenes. And it's like, okay, it's what we're watching for is that genuine moment of those interactions between people and people really and truly falling in love. And it's like, I'm not that interested in the fights of the men in the house or the women in the house. Like, okay,
right.
Some of them don't like each other. That's fine. But I'm here to see this real thing happen where these two people every so often really do find each other. And where else on TV do you get to see that? So I hope one day we'll get that like happy medium between the sort of boringness of just putting the cameras on them and seeing what happens and the sort of producer manipulations that we've gotten to now.
I agree. I'm hoping for that as well. I just feel like it's become a little bit of a caricature of itself in recent years. Given all this, like in an ideal world for you, what changes would you like to see The Bachelor and The Bachelorette and all the franchise shows make as it relates to body type diversity? And maybe as a result of your book?
That would be absolutely delightful. I would love to see them say, what if we just cast size blind and brought in a whole range of men and women who look all sorts of different ways? And that's not just size and fatness, but also ableism, right?
Sure.
All sort of people living with chronic illnesses. There's such a broad range of different types of people who could be on the show. But then I think one thing that the Batch Diversity campaign has pointed out that's so smart is that it's not just about casting. It's also about storylines. It's about supporting these people. It's about when people are facing trolls or harassment, not just sort of, I think one thing The Bachelor has been really guilty of is tokenism.
Right.
And so when we see racist trolling happening, well, it's Rachel's job to speak out against that, as opposed to the franchise saying, we don't think this is acceptable. And if you're partaking in this behavior, we're not interested in having you in Bachelor Nation. Right. First of all, casting leads who are interested in dating outside their race, outside their body type, outside their geographic area, whatever. And then saying we're going to support people who look a lot of different ways, both on the show and in terms of vetting, right? In terms of,
yes,
let's not keep casting people who have said racist things or transphobic things or anti-fat things or whatever kinds of things on their Instagrams. You know, I worked for a presidential campaign. If someone had said one of those things on their Instagram, they wouldn't be hosting a fundraiser for Hillary Clinton. Right? You have a vetting department. These are fixable problems.
Well, and they've sort of left it to viewers to vet them now. They're releasing the cast list really early in the hopes that kind of viewers will slush out this kind of stuff. But is it really the viewer's job to do that?
No, absolutely not, right? So if you're interested in making all these things your responsibility, you can make them your responsibility and then live up to it. It's not actually that difficult or that complicated.
Right.
Right? You just need to actually be interested in doing it. And I think to some extent, there's this belief that audiences don't want it or aren't interested. So one of the things that I've loved so much about seeing how much people have loved One to Watch and their responses to it, it's like, clearly the audience is here, you guys. The audience wants to see that diversity. So stop pretending that you're doing this for monetary reasons and admit that it's just prejudice.
And I would actually love to see One to Watch on TV.
I mean, you and me both, sister. From your mouth to God's ears.
Are there any shows out there that, and I guess shows or movies or any sort of like cultural touchstone type things that you think are doing it well from this respect?
I think Shrill with Aidy Bryant is so good. And I loved that memoir by Lindy West.
Yeah.
It's a great book and a great show. And particularly the first season, there's one episode where Aidy's character goes to a pool party and she's so uncomfortable being in her bathing suit in front of all these women, but it's explicitly a pool party for fat women. And she has this like revelatory experience at this pool party. And she does this monologue afterward about sort of all the different parts of her life that have been affected by this feeling that her body is somehow wrong because she's fat. And I had never heard a character talk like that on television before. So that one,
right,
that was a really meaningful one for me.
Have you heard, aside from Ashley Spivey, have you heard from anybody from Bachelor Nation about your book?
Olivia Caridi from Ben H's season, she read it and posted about it, which was awesome.
Yes, love her.
And then, of course, Reality Steve, the most important member of Bachelor Nation.
If y'all don't listen to Reality Steve's podcast regularly, go listen to the episode with Kate. It's a really, really good one.
Oh, thank you so much. He was terrific. He actually, Ashley Spivey, talked him into reading the book. And then he came to our Random House book club meeting. And he was so excited about it. He was like, you got to come on the podcast. And I was like, you're the best Reality Steve.
I'm glad that y'all paired up. That's the only natural, right?
Totally.
So I did throw out to my listeners that I was having you on, and they sent me a couple fun questions they wanted you to answer.
Oh, I'm so excited.
Real life dream bachelor, if you could cast anybody. And then we'll do the same for Bachelorette.
Well, this one's going to be wrong because he's in a wonderful relationship now.
That's
but
okay.
When I was starting out in politics, I always had like the biggest crush on Senator Cory Booker.
Oh, yes.
And so now he's with, of course, Rosario Dawson, which wonderful. And he's great. I helped write his launch video for his presidential campaign. But I feel like 5-10 years ago, he would have been an A-plus bachelor.
And interesting job to go along with it.
Totally, right? And he would have been like such all these interesting activist women, and they could have gone. And he, one thing I love about him, this will just be a Cory Booker podcast now. He always did service whenever he would be traveling for the campaign. So if he was in Des Moines doing a rally, the staff would also go to a food bank, whatever. That was really important to him to have that be a component of his campaign. And I feel like we would have seen a lot of service dates on his season of The Bachelor. And that would have been so cool to learn about sort of all the different organizations that he supports and to see them get some airtime on his season. I would love to see something like that.
Totally. And I feel like they used to do some of those kind of charity dates and they don't anymore. I can't remember seeing one recently.
Yeah, I think it must have been, I guess it was on the rewatch of Ben H's season that he and Amanda went to did something for a children's charity.
Yeah. Real life dream bachelorette.
Real life dream bachelorette. Well, Tess Holliday just announced that she's single again. She's a plus size model. She's on Instagram and Twitter and everything, but she's amazing. She's one of these women she's such a boss. She's such a badass, but she's also really open about vulnerabilities and sort of attacks that she faces as a fat woman. She's also openly queer. So that would be super cool to see a fat queer woman with maybe people of some different gender representations in her group. I think she would be an awesome bachelorette.
Favorite season of The Bachelor and favorite season of The Bachelorette?
Ooh. Well, Bachelorette is an easier one. That's Caitlin Bristow's season.
Love her.
I love her. And also like the whole Brit Caitlin disaster.
Yep.
And then Nick showing up halfway through. And she had so many good men on her season. She had Ben Higgins. She had Jared. There were so many. And like the multiple Bens. There's a joke in my book about there being many Bens on a B season. And that's a Caitlin reference for anyone who picks it up.
Yeah.
She was so funny. And she really like owned her sexuality in a way that was super cool, especially after the slut shaming we've seen on other seasons of the show. I was just a big Caitlin fan.
Yeah, I love her. And I love that she is not prim and proper.
Totally. I feel like that's always the most fun. I tend to like Bachelorette seasons better than Bachelor seasons overall.
I agree.
But favorite Bachelor season? I mean, it's like, maybe it's controversial to say, but maybe Juan Pablo, because the women were just so cool.
Interesting. Yeah.
But also maybe Ben F, because I just loved the way shit went down. It was like really Ben F's season went completely off the rails. And at some point, the producers were not in control whatsoever. And so that was a little fun to like kind of see things just go off the rails. And like the story of who was the villain and how was it supposed to play out is just not the way that it played out. So I wasn't a huge fan of Ben F, but or Juan Pablo, obviously. I don't love either of those people, but those were both really good seasons.
Well, all goes to show it doesn't really matter who the lead is sometimes.
Yeah, right. Well, and also that interesting is better than perfect when it comes to making television.
Totally. Favorite reality TV show other than The Bachelor? Well, I say The Bachelor, I mean like all The Bachelor shows.
The whole franchise. Yes. Right, because Bachelor in Paradise is actually my favorite out of the whole franchise.
Oh, mine too. But you have to watch the other two to like get to Bachelor in Paradise.
Exactly. That's the prize. Top Chef is my favorite.
Oh, love that. Favorite thing about Hillary Clinton?
She is genuinely the kindest person you will ever meet. She would write personal letters to staff during the campaign thanking us for doing our jobs, which she certainly did not need to do. We were there doing our jobs.
Right.
She read an article about a girl who'd been sold into like a child bride in a developing nation. I forget which nation it was, and had tried to help her as Secretary of State and then found that she was, something had changed in her life and she was very unhappy. And she like figured out like, can we get her a visa? Can we bring her to the US? Like, what can we do? How can we help? And that's just, I think people have such a misguided impression of her as this kind of self-serving person. And I've never met anyone less self-serving in my life. She's so kind.
That's interesting. And speaking of letters, she wrote you one about One to Watch. Do you know if she read the book? It wasn't clear from the letter.
She posted about it.
Oh, she did.
Yeah. She, on the day that the book came out, she posted about it and asked people to read it and said it was thoroughly charming, which I fainted.
Oh, that's amazing.
It was so kind of her. I knew that I wanted to send her a copy of the book and I spent 3 hours writing this card to her and sobbing the entire time. I was thinking about the day after the election when she gave this speech asking women and girls to never doubt our worth and to believe in the power of pursuing our dreams. And I would think about that moment and that she said that when I was having a really hard time writing this book, and that when she said women should pursue our dreams, that included me. And so I wanted to tell her about that. And I wrote her this note and she responded with that beautiful letter and posting about the book, which is just, she didn't have to do any of that. She's a busy lady. So it meant a lot to me.
So what's coming next for you?
Oh my gosh, so many things. I have a few projects in the works that I'm not allowed to talk about yet.
Okay, that's exciting.
But hopefully we'll be writing another book. So I'm working on a new idea and hope to be able to share more about that sometime soon.
Does it relate to One to Watch?
Nope, it's a new world, new and exciting things. You know, I'm not sure I would never return to the world of One to Watch, but I'm excited to go somewhere different for a little while.
Fair enough, fair enough. If you ever decide to go back to One to Watch, I totally concur with Reality Steve when he said you could do a Bachelor version and then you could do a Bachelor in Paradise version.
Totally. And there is, in the book, they talk about spinoff shows, and the spinoff show in the book is called Main Squeeze Mansion. Yeah. And I think that it would be really fun to see like some of the cast offs from B's season. And then at the end of the book, we do find out who the next Main Squeeze is going to be. And so to see some of the cast offs from that season as well, I think that would be a lot of fun.
Yes. All right, let's get to your book recommendations.
Yes.
As usual, Kate is going to share two old books she loves, two new books she loves, one book she does not love, and that's actually a series of multiple books, and one upcoming release that she is excited about. Tell me about the first old book you love.
So the first book is called Chemistry by Weiqi Wang. I read this book summer of 2017 when I was traveling through Europe and figuring out what the story of One to Watch was going to be. And I love this book. It's about a PhD student who kind of has a little bit of a breakdown and she's trying to figure out whether she wants to continue in her PhD or what she wants to do with her life, which I related to that moment very deeply. And I imagine a lot of us could relate to that, living through what we're living through right now. And it's just such a sharp, funny book. It's about her family and her heritage and academia and love. And it's a quick, powerful read. And I just adore that book.
I remember when it came out, I remember it getting a fair amount of buzz for like that kind of literary book. And it has an interesting structure to it, right?
Yeah. So it's told all in I think you never even learn the protagonist's name, and it feels just sort of like a stream of consciousness diary entry, the whole, and it's a short book.
Right.
And so it's literary, but it's a quick read. And I really, when I was sort of sitting, because I was in Rome by myself when I was reading it, and I was sitting the counter at all these incredible restaurants in Rome eating pasta and sort of feeling lonely and feeling like I was at an inflection point, but also feeling grateful and not knowing what came next. And it was just like one of those magical things where you're reading the perfect book for the perfect moment.
That was Chemistry by Weiqi Wang, and that came out in 2017. Tell me about this second old book you love, which is also multiple books, correct?
Yeah. So basically, I just think you should read everything by Leigh Bardugo, who's a young adult author, although her first adult book, Ninth House, came out last fall. But I personally, I'm a stan of her YA work. So she wrote a series of books called the Grisha series, and they're three books in that series, and then two books that are sort of spun off in that world called Six of Crows and Crooked Kingdom. But I would start with the original series. I believe Shadow and Bone is the first one. And it's one of those series that it's just like, it is everything you want. It is like, there is magic, there is drama, there are twists. It's set in a world that sort of mirrors kind of like 14th century Russia, and there's like a China area and a Sweden area. And so it's like there are things that are rooted in kind of these real historical cultures, but then also it's all magic and different in the books, which is so cool. They're super sexy, they're super inventive and imaginary, and they're just... Sometimes I just really love that kind of book that's like, I have to stay up all night finishing this book. I can't wait to see what happens next. And whenever I'm like really in a funk, those are the books I always turn to. I love them so much. And I hope everyone listening will love them also.
I remember when The Ninth House came out, because I'm not a fantasy reader or much of a sci-fi reader at all. So I hadn't heard of her before, but when The Ninth House came out, I remember there being such a stink about the fact that it was not a Book of the Month pick that month.
Oh.
People were just up in arms that it was not a Book of the Month pick. And I was like, who is this woman? What is this book? I've never even heard of this person. Why? Apparently I'm the only one that's never heard of her.
And Ninth House is great. I loved it. To me, Ninth House is like, it's more rooted in the real world. And it's still like, she's so smart. She's so great. I don't know how she does it.
See, that would appeal to me, I think, more. Because that's my trouble with fantasy, is I like things that are rooted in reality.
There's still like magic systems in it, but it takes place present day at Yale University, which is where she went to school. So it's more rooted in sort of the present day world. I personally... And I'm not a huge fantasy reader either, by the way, but I just really love these books.
That was the Grisha trilogy by Leigh Bardugo, and that came out in 2014-ish. Tell me about the first new book you love.
So this one, I would say that if One to Watch had sort of an evil cousin, she would be Big Summer by Jennifer Weiner, which came out earlier this year.
Ooh, interesting.
There are a lot of things about Big Summer that are sort of similar but very different to One to Watch. So there's a protagonist who's an aspiring sort of plus size Instagram influencer. So sort of this character is aspiring to be who B already is at the beginning of One to Watch. There's a character who's been on a bachelor-like reality show.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. There's a best friend who's a sort of much more famous kind of Instagram rich personality, right? And I would say that Big Summer is more focused overall on the friendship element than the sort of reality TV romance, all those elements. But Big Summer, and it has like a great twist that really changes the tone of the book a little way through, which I will not spoil for you.
Yeah.
But that book, when I picked it up, I was like, oh my God, is this too close to One to Watch? I started freaking out. And then my editor, who had already read it, was like, don't worry, it takes a turn. And indeed it did.
So did you read it before One to Watch had been published?
I forget if I was able to get a galley of that or if I bought it after it came out. In any case, yes, I read it in May. Well before, because One to Watch didn't come out until July.
I have a galley of Big Summer sitting on my Kindle that I did not read in time for publication date. So maybe I need to go back to that.
Yeah, it's a fun... And I mean, Jennifer Weiner, I don't know how she continues to put out such good books at the pace that she does, but she's just...
Truly.
A different kind of talent.
Have you read her memoir, Hungry Heart?
I have not read it. Should I?
Yes, I loved her memoir.
That's so, I'm not a memoir. I really only read fiction for the most part, but I'll give it a try.
This one read like fiction, and like her mom was a big part of the story, which it was a very interesting angle. I don't want to spoil stuff, but it was an interesting angle that her mother's story took that I really liked.
Well, hashtag mom stuff. We've all got it.
Absolutely. That was Big Summer by Jennifer Weiner, came out this summer. And tell me about the second new book you love.
So I am the biggest stan for Jasmine Guillory, who I've actually known since I was on the campaign. She followed me on Twitter because she's like very big into political Twitter. And this was before The Wedding Date came out. And I was like, I don't know who this Jasmine person is, but she's cool and smart. I'm going to follow her back. And then The Wedding Date came out and I was like, wait, my Twitter friend is a best-selling author. And so then sort of as it was getting time for One to Watch to be coming out, Jasmine was so supportive of me and really answered all my questions. And she blurbed the book. Her blurb is on the cover. And she's just been absolutely amazing in the whole process. And so her new book, Party of Two, also came out this summer. And it's been so much fun for me because I got to read her new book and I get to tell everyone about it and how much I love it. So Party of Two is sort of a vintage Jasmine Guillory joint if you read her books. I think this is my favorite one that she's written. It's about a lawyer in LA who falls in love with a senator. So it's like my Cory Booker dream season of The Bachelor come to life. And they are sort of dealing with issues in their careers and in their relationship. And it kind of reminds me of one of my favorite movies, The American President, except it's like,
yes,
updated for 2020 with like a Black protagonist and like a lot of cool anti-racist, just wonderful takes, and also a man who woos a woman by buying her cake, which, yes, to any man listening to this, that is the right answer. Buy cake for the women that you like.
Right.
So this one was just a total during a time and a summer in our lives where I would imagine we are not experiencing perhaps as much joy as we might during a different summer. This book really brought me a lot of joy, and I just had a smile on my face the whole time I was reading it.
Her agent came on the podcast.
Oh, really?
A couple months ago. Yeah, Holly Root. And she told the whole story of sort of selling Jasmine Guillory to publishers and how she went about that and sort of paving the way for this big blow up in rom-coms.
That's so cool. I mean, no one deserves it more. Good for her.
That was Party of Two by Jasmine Guillory, and that came out in April. And tell us about the book or books. I'm not sure if you've read more than one of these.
I did not, in fact, even read one of these. Well, I stopped halfway through.
Oh, yeah. You do. Okay, that counts.
So the book that I didn't love is Game of Thrones by George R.R. Martin. So I'm a fan of the show, or I was until the final season when they ruined everything. Initially, I didn't like the show because I didn't understand anything that was happening. And then a friend of mine read the books and she was able to explain it all to me. And she would talk about, well, this and well, that. And she was so excited. And I was like, cool, I'm going to read the books and then I'm going to be excited like you. But by that point, I had already watched either the first season or the first two seasons, but the first season is sort of covers everything that's in the first book. So I picked up the first book and I was so excited. It was so long.
Yes.
And it was so many things that I already knew happened. And I sort of found it to be, you never, like, it's interesting sometimes when the audience knows more than a character, but you never want to feel like you're smarter than a character. Right? That feels like that can be a kind of annoying way to read. So like there's a big twist that Ned, the main character, uncovers in the first book. And I, of course, already knew the twist from having seen the show. So I was just kind of like, get there, Ned. Like, come on, it's right in front of you. And I just had a very frustrating reading experience. So I had to put it down and say, sorry, George R.R. Martin, I'm sure my personal feelings on that book will not affect his bottom line. But that one just wasn't for me.
I think he's fine financially. How far did you make it?
A few hundred pages.
Oh, so basically, if it were a normal sized book, you would have finished the book.
I would have been done. Exactly.
Okay.
That happened to me too. Now that I'm thinking of it with The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I got like 100 pages into it.
Oh.
I was like, this is so boring. I cannot read it. And my friend who had read it was like, you know, it really picks up after the horrific rape scene. And I was like, I think I'm good. I think I'm all set with this one.
See, I loved the Dragon Tattoo books, but it's been a long time. Like my, you know, people's reading taste changes and whatever. It's been a long time since I read those.
Totally.
Well, rumor has it George R. R. Martin is finally going to publish a book this year, or he says it's this like running. Do you listen to the Book Riot podcast at all?
I don't.
So they frequently update their listeners about the latest that George R. R. Martin has said about how his next book is coming, and that it keeps getting pushed back and keeps getting pushed back, and he's never seems to be working on it. And he published something in June on his blog that was like, COVID has really helped me focus. I'm in a cabin in the mountains, and you'll get something in 2021. I don't know. But everyone's laughing because he's said things like that many times before.
Well, I hope all of his devoted readers are rewarded for their devotion, and I hope that they love the new book.
Me too. I'm not one of those. I'm not a fantasy person, so I have not even attempted to read Game of Thrones, nor did I watch the TV show.
I loved the show, and actually it's interesting because the show made a lot of sort of misogynist choices, where I'm told the book made more feminist choices. So I was interested in that as well, but I just couldn't stick it out to get there. So thankfully I fell in love with a few different Game of Thrones podcasts and with some feminist writers who write about Game of Thrones. So I was able to just read their work, and I was like, great, I don't have to form my own opinions here. I can listen to yours.
Perfect. That was Game of Thrones by George R. R. Martin. And tell me about the upcoming release that you're excited about. And I think a lot of people will probably really be excited about this one, too.
Yeah, I was like, should I try and pick something no one's heard of? And then I was like, I'll just tell the truth. I'm really excited for Ready Player Two by Ernest Cline. I loved the book Ready Player One, which actually I also read in the summer of 2017. I read that one in Switzerland, sort of in a cabin in the mist, and it was the perfect read for that kind of a vibe, and I loved it so much. I just absolutely tore through it. If you read One to Watch, there are a ton of pop culture references in One to Watch, and Ready Player One has a million pop culture references. That I'm a 90s kid, and I was born in 83, so it was a lot of stuff from my childhood that I really loved. I didn't know that he was writing a sequel, so when it got announced, I was like, oh my god, I'm so excited. So I hope that it lives up to the first one, and I can't wait to read it.
Do you know anything else about it? Because when I looked it up, there's not a plot summary on Goodreads or on the publisher's website or on Edelweiss. There's literally nothing about it, which it's coming out in November. And that's, you normally have that kind of information by now. What does that mean?
I know. I'll tell you, not only do I not know anything about it, we share a publisher and they won't tell me anything about it.
Oh, interesting. Is it like embargoed? Is that why?
I assume they have some sort of a rollout strategy that they were like, no, Kate, we don't trust you, which, fair enough, I'm a terrible gossip. So, you know, I guess I'll have to find out along with everyone else.
You know what? That makes you a good podcast guest.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so I don't know what that means. I don't know if it means that there's no information out about it, but I guess we'll have to wait till November 24th to find out.
I'm excited.
All right. We are closing out the episode with our final question that I ask every guest. Tell me the last 5-star book you read.
Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reed.
Yes.
I had heard from everyone how great the book was, and I picked it up and spent all weekend reading it. I could not put it down. And I thought, especially at a moment where a lot of us are thinking about issues of racism and what that looks like in our own life and what more we can do, I think a lot of people still think racism is just like, oh, I'm not going to hire you because you're Black and I'm going to use the N-word, right? And it's often a lot more subtle and a lot more insidious than that in terms of our interpersonal relationships.
Sure.
And I thought that Such a Fun Age, aside from being a totally funny, unputdownable page turner, really had a lot of incredibly smart things to say about that topic, and especially how subtly racism can manifest itself in really liberal white circles, which are a lot of the circles that I've been a part of, although I grew up in a really diverse town and have been lucky to be surrounded not just by white people my whole life. But I just loved that book. Couldn't put it down. Really easy 5 stars for me.
There are some cringy scenes in there on the race point. Yep. I remember being like, oh my Lord. That's probably the point though. I mean, I think that's probably the point. You're supposed to cringe.
Yeah. And I think that even in those cringy moments, the reason you cringe is that you recognize it.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. So maybe if, you know, you or I have never behaved in quite that excessive a way, there's the cringe is like, oh, I know something I've done that's some version of this. Right. Then it forces you to examine yourself and sort of how you see yourself as a person and the way you want to behave and sort of comport yourself in the world, which of course is just one step of anti-racism, right? The bigger and more important step is being involved in the movement. But I thought in terms of that first piece that this book nailed it in a way that I hadn't seen anytime recently.
All right. That was Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reed. And that came out December 31st, 2019, which is the strangest publication date I've ever heard. But that's when it came out.
Worked for them.
It did. It did. And also, it has now been longlisted for the 2020 Booker Prize.
Oh, that's amazing. Good for Kylie Reed.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much, Kate. This has been so much fun. I have loved melding books and Bachelor today.
Oh, well, I do it every day. My pleasure.
Can I live your life?
Books and Bachelor.
Sounds awesome, except for the 100-degree heat.
Yeah, exactly.
So y'all, the September Superlatives episode for patrons will air at the end of the month, and it will include Kate's picks for categories like favorite Bachelor and Bachelorette villain and favorite and least favorite past Bachelor contestants. If you'd like to get this bonus episode plus others, you can support the show for $5 a month on Patreon. There is a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio. And remember that episodes are airing bi-weekly until I can get a feel for my schedule with my kids learning virtually from my house. So in 2 weeks, which is September 30th, Kelly Jensen of Book Riot will be joining me to talk about how coronavirus is impacting libraries. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Thanks so much for listening to Sarah's Bookshelves Live. You can find show notes with all the books mentioned in the episode, purchase links, and linked timestamps at www.sarahsbookshelves.com/podcast. And that's Sarah with an H. I'd love to hear your comments, feedback, and suggestions. You can find me online on my blog, sarahsbookshelves.com, on Twitter at Sarah's Shelves, on Instagram at Sarah's Bookshelves, and via email at sarahsbookshelves@gmail.com. And if you'd like to get exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast, you can support us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/sarahsbookshelves. And there's a link in the show notes and in my Instagram bio to my Patreon page. Thanks for listening.